Hi, I'm Femi Okeh. Thanks for watching the stream. Back in April of 2020, I hosted the stream from my house for months and months and months. We did from April all the way through to June, 28 back-to-back COVID-related shows. There was so much to learn. There was so much we didn't know. So, 2 years into our global pandemic, what do we need to know now? Today's episode is all about catching up with the latest news from COVID, and I can't do that without you. Your questions, your comments, put them into YouTube, and I will wrap them into today's show. Let us meet our panel of doctors. So I'm going to say hello to Margaret, to Ahmed, and to Marion. Good to have you all here on the stream. Margaret, please remind our audience who you are and what you do.
Hi, Femi. It's great to be back with you. I'm a doctor, also a journalist, and I specialise in public health, emergency risk communications, and work for the World Health Organization.
Ah, so good to have you. It's like having a family reunion. Ahmed, welcome back to the stream. We always love having you on the stream. Please remind our audience who you are and what you do.
Thanks for having me. So my name's Ahmed. I am a doctor in emergency medicine, as well as being a journalist.
Good to have you. And hello, Marion. Welcome to the stream. Please introduce yourself to our viewers around the world.
Yes, good evening. I'm Marion Koopmans. I'm head of virology of Erasmus Medical Center, and I'm obviously a virologist and a veterinarian by background and work on emerging viruses.
Guess, what is the most important piece of COVID-related news you have heard recently? Marion, you start.
Well, it's actually two examples. One is the situation in China with the challenge in trying to control the outbreak in Shanghai and now moving to Guangzhou. So the phase that China is and the challenges that China is facing with particularly Omicron. And the second example is coming from South Africa, where it looks like two new variants of Omicron have been popping up, BA4 and 5, and that's something we need to keep our eyes out for.
All right, and that is news to me. Thank you for that, because we're going to talk about variants in just a moment. Ahmed, news to you, news you need to share, COVID-related, what is it?
I think it's the idea of, I guess, tests being less available. I think, like, the UK released that they're going to stop making tests being freely available for people, which is just going to make it more and more difficult for us to spot these new variants that are coming up. So that's one of the things that I think is quite surprising to hear about, but in a way understandable.
And Margaret, your headline.
Just tonight we got some very good news out of an unexpected place, Ukraine. They've become a spoke of the hub, the messenger RNA hub. And what that means, the messenger RNA hub is based in South Africa, but they're providing the expertise to companies in countries around the world so that the messenger RNA technology for vaccines can be shared. And Ukraine's become the latest to have a company doing this. It's just starting now.
Wow, that's extraordinary. My first thought, other than these important news stories and these news developments that you've brought to us, doctors, is how are we doing as a world? Dr. Carissa Etienne is the director of the Pan America Health Organization. This is how she summarized how we're doing. Have a listen, have a look.
Over the last few weeks, many countries and territories in the Americas have scaled back public health measures, and some have done so prematurely. As travel restrictions have loosened, case counts have risen in places that rely on tourism, especially in parts of North America and the Caribbean, where vaccination coverage is low.
Marion, I see you nodding. This is how we're behaving in some parts of the world, obviously having impact on other parts of the world. Your thoughts about what Dr. Carissa had to say there?
Well, this is exactly the phase we are in. There was a World Health Organization, the IHR Emergency Committee meeting this week that looked at where are we with this pandemic. And it's actually this sort of global split where you have countries where, because of the situation, the virus is running quite high because there's not many restrictions anymore. And there's other parts of the world that are still trying to very much contain and are looking at this. So we have this diversion in the world, and it's a challenging phase because we are in this transition from the really acute phase of the pandemic to somewhere in the future. But what exactly that future will be, we are not sure yet. So we still have to be on our toes about what this virus can do, which surprises we can see. And the conclusion also of the emergency committee meeting was, please do not think this is over. Please keep looking at this as the public health emergency that it is, and that requires global coordinated action.
Margaret, go ahead.
So, yes, and Marion is absolutely right. In fact, there was very little debate in the emergency committee on whether public health emergency of international concern exists. And it is very concerning that a lot of countries, we're looking, when we look at our numbers, where the testing strategies are changing. Countries are dropping the number of tests they're doing. So even though we're reporting lower numbers of cases, our epidemiologists are saying that our numbers should be interpreted with caution because so many countries are not just dropping their restrictions, but no longer doing the testing, no longer really tracking what's happening with this virus. And that is really concerning.
Ahmed, this is exactly what you were saying. In the UK, they are stopping funding free testing. So you're on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, as in, it's quite a complicated thing. And I can see the point of why free testing is important, especially for us in terms of trying to find what the any new variants that are coming up and things like that. But at the same time, it's reached a position where, as in, yes, numbers hit the records high of coronavirus in the past week in the UK, but it didn't reflect that in terms of hospital admissions that I was seeing. As in, I was spending, let's say, a whole week in the resus department, so the most sick patients that came into the emergency department, and none of them were any of the COVID patients or suffering from any symptoms of coronavirus. They may have coronavirus, but they've come in presenting with appendicitis, and it just in case came with coronavirus. So there is a risk to remove some of these measures, but at the same time, you know, we're not testing everyone who comes in with the influenza and having to work out exactly what strain of influenza it is or exactly what strain of coronavirus. Coronavirus isn't a new virus. It's been around for years, but it's just that in 2020, it, I guess, mutated into something that became very deadly and spread rapidly. Maybe it's something that's mutated into something less deadly. The vaccines are working. But it's just difficult to balance it. It is very expensive to continue these tests, especially for some of the poorer countries around the world, to continue providing free PCR tests and things like that.
I think so. The testing has actually two goals, and I think that's what we really need to take apart. Testing has been really a pillar of our ability to know who was infected, who needed isolation, and who you could then also put into quarantine. Now that is now loosened, certainly in, for instance, in Europe, because of this decoupling between infection and severe disease. And that is because of the high level of vaccination. Now that situation is very different if you are in a region where you don't have that high coverage, or if we would face a new variant that we cannot be sure that they will all have this same relatively mild disease presentation. So that's a reason why I think at least the infrastructure for that testing needs to be treasured so that it can be put back up when needed.
This is my layperson's question. If we're not testing widely, how do we know about new variants? So, Marion, you told us about new variants in South Africa. Can you tell us what they are and should we be disturbed by them? Are they variants of concern?
So we don't know that yet. What we do know is that there is in two regions in South Africa now an increase of these new variants, BA4 and BA5, over the previous variants. And so these are variants of Omicron. So they are essentially Omicron viruses with some additional mutations. And those mutations are in spots that makes us think it could do something to how immunity protects. Mm-hmm. We don't know that for sure yet. That needs to be validated, and that's work that's ongoing, and that will be looked at by the WHO in the coming weeks. But it is an example of the kind of surprise we can still expect with these viruses, as long as they keep circulating so widely.
Can I add to just really emphasize that point that Marion's making? She mentioned there were two reasons for testing. One is indeed to know who's infected, to keep the infected away from the healthy. But the other big thing, and the thing we're very concerned about, is if you're not testing, we're not going to be able to do the genetic sequencing to identify the variants. Now, we're really lucky the South Africans have done this great work. This is the second time around they've really shown what doing the work achieves. But we need this to be happening everywhere. We've got huge amounts of virus circulating. We've seen that with Omicron, we've already got 5 sublineages, and several of them are causing a lot of trouble. So if we're not tracking, we're not finding out whether there's something around the corner that's going to give us a lot more trouble.
This is a real debate, right? Because if you're not testing because you can't afford it, then you're not going to know something that could really cost you later down the line. Ahmed.
No, it's quite complicated because let's say you've got symptoms, you've got the cold, like you've got a fever, you've got a bit of a cough, and you test and you know COVID comes out negative. Does that mean you're safe to go out and like walk around in the cities and go spread whatever virus you have? You may have another virus, it's just not COVID, right? So it's quite complicated to be like, we need to just keep testing for this one specific virus. Why aren't we testing for other viruses as well? The other influenzas out there that may be more deadly to the vulnerable population than the Omicron variant of COVID is to some people. So it's quite difficult to say, let's just keep testing so that we can protect COVID. I do agree. We need to maintain an infrastructure.
I do believe influenza. We do test for influenza around the world. We do sentinel surveys all the time. In all parts of the world. You're quite right, we don't do population-wide. We do it through various general practices, designated places, but we test for influenza.
I do understand what Ahmed is saying, I have a cough, I immediately go and get a test to check to see if I've got COVID because I'm working in an environment with other colleagues and I need to make sure I'm not spreading COVID to them. Before 2020, if I had a cough, I might probably come to work, which is a terrible thing, but we've actually learned better social distancing and better practices over the last 2 years than we probably have done for all of that period up to then. Let me just bring in another doctor into our conversation. This is Dr. Ogwell. He's the Deputy Director of Africa CDC. This is what he told us earlier.
Today, only 15% of the African population is fully vaccinated, and this is very far from the target that we have set of 70% by the end of this year, 2022. Two key challenges that are facing the continent from a delivery perspective, getting the vaccines from the storage. Secondly, from a public perspective, members of the public find it difficult to leave their economic activities to go and get vaccinated. These two, when they are solved, then we will start seeing the vaccination rates increase on the continent.
So Nadia asked us, as she knew we were doing this episode, what is the holdup in vaccination rates in some parts of the world? Is it still a supply issue or lack of confidence in the vaccine among some communities? Margaret, I'm going to ask you to handle this one because the WHO by this point was expecting 70% of countries to have been vaccinated by now. Margaret, help us out with this.
Yes, certainly. And it was a supply issue, but that was last year's problem. So now, in fact, it's almost flipped the other way. We have got a really good supply, but countries that have been waiting and waiting, but didn't know when they were going to get anything, understandably hadn't got their teams ready. I didn't have their teams on standby because they didn't know they'd have a vaccine. Now, suddenly the tap has not only been opened, it's flooding, and not every country is ready. So we're now working very, very hard, particularly with countries that are struggling to go from getting the vaccine from the airport through the cold chain via the teams into people's arms. That has improved. I mean, in the last month, I think we delivered 77 million. But there are countries with very, very low vaccination rates. Some of The other problem is indeed hesitancy. People in countries that were waiting for a year to get vaccines have become very suspicious suddenly that they've got a lot of vaccine coming. They're saying, well, why have we got it now? Is it the bad vaccine? So you do have that lack of supply actually led to greater hesitancy. Mm. Other issues are just simply getting the teams, funding the teams, having the transport, the logistics, even the petrol to put in the cars and the boats and feeding the donkeys that you have to to feed to get out to wherever you go. So it's much more difficult than simply sending it. But last year, just getting hands on vaccine was the problem.
On YouTube, I've got this question. I'm going to share it with you, Ahmed. Actually, you go ahead, because I know you've got more to say about vaccine inequity, and then I'll put this YouTube question to you. Go ahead.
Well, I think one of the things that I want to highlight is, instead of like having this huge focus on trying to get as much testing and maintaining testing available, getting these vaccines out there, spreading the awareness about what they are is essentially, I guess, key to making sure that we do have immunity towards Omicron or COVID in general. But the real question is that, like you said, the vaccine inequality is out there. Like, the prices are rising every 6 months or so. Pfizer decides to increase the price of its own vaccine. So when we say that people are struggling to get vaccines in like poorer countries, part of the reason is that I know there are cheaper vaccine options out there available, but some of them don't have as strong immunity as possible as other vaccines that we're using in the West. So it is about trying to make it a level playing field. These vaccines weren't made just out of private investment. A lot of the vaccines came out of public funding. So I know, as much as people like to bash Donald Trump, he put millions of dollars into vaccine development, which is public funding. This should be publicly available to people around the world, not just maintained in private institutions.
Marion, I had this question on YouTube. I want to share it with you. And it was a question about, how do we find trust in public officials, in medical professionals, because there's been 2 years of misinformation, as well as great information, but misinformation and disinformation as well. In fact, on YouTube right now, I'm not even going to let you look at YouTube right now, because there's some stuff going on there that even 2 years into a pandemic, there's still misinformation flying around. Are we better at coping with that now? Are we more savvy about understanding what is accurate, what is inaccurate?
Well, I think that's one of the big challenges of this pandemic. It's also been called the infodemic. And certainly around vaccination, there's a lot of stories out there that if people just go on the internet and Google, may come across. So I think what we've learned, that it is important to really have trusted sources. What there's been studies that have shown people trust their own physicians, for instance, better than some others. And it is important to find those trusted sites of information that maybe also you can put on your website after the program, because it is a struggle. And but we also have to be careful. There's a lot of people that have questions about vaccines that are valid, that just need to be answered. They are not entirely sure, that it's not being anti-vaccine. It's just someone who really wants to understand what these vaccines do and do not do. And so it is important to really have the patients provide that information carefully, say what we know, say what we don't know. And that, I think, in the end, is really what is needed.
I'm going to bring in a new doctor. So many doctors on this show. So much information, good information. Dr. Lucy McBride is a primary care doctor, and she's pushing us in the direction of adapting to the global pandemic that we're in right now. How should we behave going forward? Here she is.
As a primary care doctor who sees teenagers, the parents of younger children, and as a mother myself, my biggest concern about kids and teenagers right now is the effect of prolonged school closures on their social, emotional, and medical health. At this moment of the pandemic, it's appropriate to recognize that children and teens as an age cohort face the lowest risk for serious outcomes from COVID, yet have been subjected to some of the strictest mitigation measures. It's time for us to recognize that children have broad health and human needs, that we need to address their mental and physical health in tandem, and that it's time for them to be back in school with their peers, their mentors, their teachers unrestricted, and it's time to mitigate the risk of COVID-19 alongside the risk for other health harms that they inevitably face.
I'm going to start with Ahmed on this one, because we have a generation now, a pandemic generation of kids. And I'm sure you've been on social media and you've seen kids that were barking at the dog, and they were barking because they hadn't socialised because they'd been at home for a whole year and they hadn't met anybody. And all sorts of interesting things have happened to our youngsters, our young generation, because they've been growing up in a pandemic. What do we do about that, Ahmed? What do you think? How do we move forward now?
I think it's really quite difficult. There was a paper released a couple of months ago looking at these children who, you know, all their schools, their lessons, everything was done on iPads or laptops and things like that. That there's actually going to, there's being evidence of withdrawal symptoms from gadgets as soon as they start going back into schools and inability to focus, things like that. It's quite dangerous to think about a whole generation of people who haven't really engaged. And I don't, we don't really know what the issues are going to be in the future for them, if they're going to have any other forms of social anxiety. And that's something that I think is urgent for us to tackle, because that these are our future generations, right? So what we need to be doing is slowly re-engaging them back into school. Some of them have this fear of, you know, socializing with their friends, going outside, not because fear of the virus, but generally because they haven't engaged with anyone other than their own parents. So we need to try to make going back to school as fun, as quick, and as smooth as possible for them, not adding extra restrictions to them and, you know, you need to be far away from the child next door. I don't think that's really, in the long term, in this current environment, something that's safe for children to continue going through.
I have one more piece.
I think that there's also been, that's also been mentioned, right, recommended by the WHO, that in this phase of the pandemic, really school closures should be avoided, which also means looking at the future, the near future, the winter, where we have to prepare for possible increases again, but where the recommendation is the last thing you do is close schools, because exactly of the reasons that were explained there. Having said that, there's also things that can be done in schools. There's the issue of ventilation, and there is the thinking about if the numbers increase again, what can we do also in the school system to help sort of limit the spread a little bit without closing the schools. And that's certainly something that is recommended in the different parts of the world now.
Mm-hmm. Marion, thoughts about...
Thanks, Marion, for saying those things.
Yeah, Margaret, go ahead.
We've been working very hard, not just us, but the UNICEF, our sister agency, have really been looking at what can we do to make schools safer, better, not just for COVID, but for all respiratory diseases. I think anybody who's had a child knows that they constantly have a cold because their kids brought some yet another thing back home from school. So let's take this opportunity to make them places where our kids don't constantly get respiratory illnesses, improve the ventilation, improve the way they interact, and do so much more. We owe it to this generation to give them a better chance of much better health through going to school.
Thank you so much.
I just wanted to add...
Yes, Ahmed, you've got just less than 30 seconds, so I'm going to give you a sentence. Go ahead.
It's just how extremely unethical it is for us to see sold-out arenas like the Super Bowl, packed 100,000 people there, or the NBA playoffs, yet we still have some schools that are closed or over
Ahmed,
Zoom.
Thank you so much. There's always so much to talk about when we're catching up on the latest from COVID. Thank you to Drs. Ahmed, Marianne and Margaret. I am going to leave you with a campaign that was a joint campaign from Africa CDC and MasterCard Foundation. It is young people across Africa doing their best to encourage other young people to get vaccinated. Thanks for watching. See you next time. What we do, what we do, what we do.